Hello everybody and welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm Johnny Arola. Big ol' show planned for you with Emma Viglin once again joining us to break down the big news of the day. And there is a lot of news. We've got just days until the Iowa caucus. And already, the fact that in all of these polls, Bernie Sanders is starting to move up and up and up a little bit is leading to a big preemptive counterattack. And it's coming in both ad form, article form, op-ed form, and soon financial form as well. We're gonna be breaking all of that down. But there's so much more than just that. In fact, there's too much. So why don't we just get into it? Yesterday, there was a number of different, Trump lawyers who were standing up in his defense. One of them, Robert Ray, said something that I think a lot of people just sort of passed over without understanding the significance of it. But take a look at this video, see if you can catch what I'm talking about.
Now, I know that many of you may come to conclude or may have already concluded that the call was less than perfect. And I have said on any number of occasions previously and publicly that it would have been better in attempting to spur action by a foreign government in coordinating law enforcement efforts with our government to have done so through proper channels.
Okay, the stuff he says at the end, I'll get back to that. But did you notice what I'm talking about? Did you hear what he said? Listen again.
The call was less than perfect.
Less than perfect. Less than perfect.
Less than perfect? If I know one thing, Robert Ray, supposed Trump lawyer, it's that that call was perfect. And the reason I know that is I only have one source for my news, and it's Twitter.com/RealDonaldTrump, where I've seen tweets like this. Tweet after tweet after tweet after tweet, indeed, interview after interview after interview. Perfect, perfect, it's a call and it's perfect. How many different ways can he say it, Robert Ray, before it gets through your thick skull? The call was perfect and you say you are a defender of the president. You don't know the first thing about defense, okay? But anyway, there. All he's saying is, yeah, we've read the transcript and it doesn't look great. And yet, like something, something heads on pikes. If I was Robert Ray, I would be worried because he didn't just sort of undercut rhetorically a bit of the president's defense. It's the part that Donald Trump has obsessively, bizarrely focused on. None of the substance of what was actually happening, the whole timeline, all of the witness testimony, all of that. But just the nature and specific wording of the call and how perfect it was, a word that never made sense. I get the strategy, I do. He's trying to reassure some Republican senators who have like an echo of a conscience or an echo of a concern for the Constitution. But for Donald Trump, I don't know if that is going to be enough to save Robert Ray's job. And the reason I think that is because as we've previously laid out, there is no amount of loyalty high enough that will stop Donald Trump from throwing you under the bus. And that was not just true, for the entirety of the time we've known him as a politician, but indeed it was true even today with him tweeting this. Really pathetic how Fox News is trying to be so politically correct by loading the airwaves with Democrats like Chris Van Hollen, the no-name senator from Maryland. Well, apparently he has a name, you know it, you tweeted it. He has been on forever playing up the impeachment hoax. Dems wouldn't even give Fox their low ratings debates. So what the hell has happened to Fox News? Only I know Chris Wallace and others should be on fake news CNN or MSDNC. How's Shep Smith doing? Watch, this will be the beginning of the end for Fox, just like the other two, which are dying in the ratings. Social media is great. So what you're seeing is Donald Trump, who is so angry that Fox News had a Democrat on, that he is threatening them with extinction, basically. They're saying they're the same thing as CNN and MSNBC. Here's the thing, I'm not gonna go through all of the different shows on Fox News yesterday, but if you didn't watch it, I doubt you will be surprised to find out that they reacted to the John Bolton revelations in the most pro-Trump defensive, reactionary, groveling way imaginable. Laura Ingraham's show, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, obviously, all of it was forget this guy. He's, in the words, not just Fox News, Fox Business, Lou Dobbs said he's a tool for the left. One of them, I think it might have been Tucker Carlson, said the fact that the book came out when it did, right during the impeachment, that's the normal sort of Democrat trick. He's not a Democrat, he's a Republican. He's a super hardcore neocon Republican. But they were tripping over themselves to be the most out in front defending Donald Trump, denying any significance of this. Yesterday in the show, we showed you Steve Doocy, who has totally turned around from just a few months ago, where he was saying, if there was a quid pro quo, that is off the rails bad. Now it's, who cares about this? It's, oh God, we almost got through without witnesses. And still, the same as CNN, the same as MSNBC. And so today, I'm a little bit worried about Robert Ray. I'm the only one who's really worrying about him. But anyway, with that, I do want to turn to one other aspect of the defense yesterday. Rudy Giuliani had his own defenders, you know, in the Senate trial. One of them was Trump lawyer Jane Raskin, who she had a number of different arguments meant to effectively befuddle people about what Giuliani was actually doing and lay out mutually exclusive ideas of what he was doing that make him immune from any sort of criticism. It is difficult to understand her point, but I am going to try as we work through a few of the highlights of it. So Jane Raskin said that Democrats would have subpoenaed Giuliani if they were serious about getting to the bottom of his actions. But of course, they did subpoena him for documents related to his Ukraine work, and he ignored it. So again, just like Donald Trump's tweets yesterday, where he argued that if John Bolton had known anything, the Democrats would have tried to get him to testify, although of course they did try to get him to testify on October 30th. So in both of these cases, we're supposed to believe that John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani are irrelevant. That is shown by the fact that the Democrats didn't try to get them to testify, even though in fact they did try to get them to testify. So my brain's already hurting, but we'll press on. She said, it's in plain sight, and Mr. Giuliani has told any number of news outlets exactly when and why he became interested in the issue. It had nothing to do with the 2020 election. Mayor Giuliani began investigating Ukraine corruption and interference in the 2020 election. Back in November of 2018, a full 6 months before Vice President Biden announced his candidacy and 4 months before the release of the Mueller report. Okay, so they're going to try to have their cake and eat it too, and a few other forms of cake activity all at the same time. So he was there having nothing to do with 2020. He was just there to defend Donald Trump over this whole thing that was going on over the Mueller report. Again, this is before the release of the Mueller report. That was on their mind. And in fact, it was 6 months before Joe Biden even declared that he'd be running. Now, briefly, let's stop there. Because how simple-minded, how cultish in your devotion to Donald Trump do you have to be to believe the argument that 6 months before Joe Biden announced his candidacy for the 2020 primary, they weren't worried, they weren't thinking about it. In fact, nobody even knew that he would run. Nobody was thinking about Joe Biden. Come on, seriously? Look, he might not have run, that's possible, but there was every reason to believe that he was going to. He'd already given multiple interviews saying he was keeping his options open. He had been the vice president, he was a senator, he thought about running back in 2016. Seriously, are you trying to make the case that they couldn't have possibly tried to start a scheme to get an investigation into Joe Biden because nobody knew that he'd run? That is infantile, and yet that's the defense of Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump that we saw from Jane Raskin on the floor of the Senate. We'll press on. As President Trump's highest profile defense attorney, the former New York City mayor, often known simply as Rudy, believed the Ukrainian evidence could assist in his defense against the Russian collusion investigation and former special counsel Robert Mueller's final report. Okay, again, they want you to believe somehow, against everything that we found out over the past 3 or 4 months, that he was there having nothing to do with Joe Biden. In fact, they're not even talking about corruption for the most part anymore. It was just about the Mueller report and what Ukraine supposedly knew about what was happening there. What does that have to do with Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, Burisma, corruption, Poroshenko, any of them? It has nothing to do with anything. She is just taking at face value the Ukraine-centered conspiracy theories that many Republicans have taken up over the past few years to explain all of what supposedly actually happened in 2016 involving election interference. It makes absolutely no sense. It undercuts virtually everything that Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani have said about why he was there. They've now jettisoned all the corruption stuff. It's just that it was about the Mueller report. And the thing is, she can try to do that, she'll stick to the script that she's been given, but Rudy Giuliani is a literal crazy person. And so he tweeted about Jane Raskin, see if he can keep it together. He tweeted, Jane Raskin is doing a masterful job defending me in my role as defense counsel. As she pointed out, I did not dig up dirt on Joe Biden. The information re his outrageous criminal conduct was handed to me, along with a videotape for witnesses and incriminating documents. It was already a fully intact bribery extortion case. Blah, blah, blah. So he's like, she's doing a masterful job defending me, saying that it had nothing to do with corruption, Joe Biden, any of that. It all had to do with Ukraine. Pause for 1 second. They just handed me all this stuff about Joe Biden. It was awesome. There's totally a case there, totally bribery, corruption, all of that. He can't keep the new defense together for the span of 280 characters. Now, there's one last bit of her defense of Rudy Giuliani that I found pretty funny, especially with him lauding her defense of him. Here's a little mashup of a few of her comments.
Rudy Giuliani is the House manager's colorful distraction. But I suggest to you that he's front and center in their narrative for one reason and one reason alone. To distract from the fact that the evidence does not support their claims. But in this trial, in this moment, Mr. Giuliani is just a minor player. That shiny object designed to distract you.
So I love the idea of Rudy Giuliani like thanking her for referring to him as a shiny object, a distraction. And she said there, the Democrats are focusing on Rudy Giuliani for one reason, and that is as a distraction because there's no evidence. Here's the thing, I would love a world where Rudy Giuliani was just a shiny object and a distraction, that there was no reason to focus on him. Here's the thing, I'm less concerned with the fact that the Democrats are focused on Rudy Giuliani and more that the president of the United States has positioned him above the State Department, above the Department of Justice. If he's a shiny object, he's distracting Donald Trump because Donald Trump decided to take him, put him in Ukraine to do shadow diplomacy, having nothing to do with the Mueller report and all of that. It was designed to do one thing, get an announcement of an investigation into Joe Biden. That is the truth. And think about the strategy that she's just laid out. He's a distraction because there's no evidence, even though all of his activity is the evidence. So if you ever want to commit a crime, just have one of your lackeys do it. That way, anytime they talk about the activities of that lackey, you can say that that's just a distraction from the crime evidence that you don't have. It's maddening. The entire thing is sheer insanity. And it makes me wonder, honestly, if she was chosen to defend Rudy Giuliani by Rudy Giuliani, because that's the only thing at this point that actually makes any sense. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Emma Vigeland is gonna be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court announced that they would allow the Trump administration's effective wealth test for green card applicants to stand, which is certainly bad news for people who care about immigration policy in a non-cruel fashion. Joining us to break down this and other big news of the day, Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is back on the show.
How you doing, John?
How's it going, Emma? Good to have you here. I want your thoughts on this, but let me give people just a little bit more information before we jump into it. So effectively, by dramatically expanding the definition of a quote public charge or an economic burden on society, the US Citizenship and Immigration Services regulation gives officials more power to deny visas and green card applications from immigrants and prospective immigrants whom the government determines rely or could rely on certain public benefits like food stamps and government housing programs. And to give you an idea of how broad the leeway is for making the determination that these people will be public charges, a term that I absolutely hate, the rule also allows immigrants to be declared a public charge and denied green cards even if they're employed. They literally have employment. No, I think that you're going to be a drain on society. And by the way, effectively, the Supreme Court overruled a lower court ruling that called this repugnant to the American dream. The Supreme Court apparently feels otherwise. Emma, what do you think about this development?
It's just a needlessly cruel rule by the Trump administration and a subsequently cruel decision by the Supreme Court. But this is what happens when we have Republicans in office, right? So when people said they were going to vote third party or, you know, not vote for Hillary Clinton because of all of her numerous problems, look, you know, this is the argument that a lot of people made, including myself, about how the Republican far-right administration would stack the courts with just demonic, terrible judges who would make rulings like this. And we're seeing this at the highest level on the Supreme Court with a majority voting 5-4. And then you have Ruth Bader Ginsburg leading Elena Kagan, Sotomayor, the rest of the liberal justices voting against it. But that's not enough. And the even more insidious form of this is in the lower courts, which doesn't get a lot of publicity, appellate courts, other lower forms that people don't really look at that much. And that's the insidious nature of all of this.
Yeah, and you could expect a lot more 5-4 decisions like this going forward, at the very least, let alone if he gets another justice, another two justices in a full term. I mean, like, it's going to be a fun time in the news for the next few decades after that. Now, really fast, I want to get your reaction to one of the presidential candidates' reactions to this change that really gets to the heart of how ridiculous this change is. Now, as an outsider looking at the Republican strategy, I think of this change as basically perfect. It's like chef's kiss perfect. It's implying that these immigrants are just going to be a drain on American society. But the great thing about it is you don't have to demonstrate it. It doesn't matter if it's true. Just by publicizing the change, you reinforce the stereotype that we know is not true statistically. But here is what Bernie Sanders had to say. He tweeted, "My father came to America at 17 without a nickel, speaking no English. He grew up to be the proudest American you ever saw. Trump's policy is disgraceful. It is not what America is about. We will defeat him and end his demonization of immigrants and the poor." And that's the thing, like when you think about the immigrant experience historically, the idea has always been, whatever people say, like, hey, this was my parents' experience, my grandparents' experience, it's always they came with almost nothing. If they were millionaires, they probably didn't want to come in the first place. And yet they came and worked hard and they made America what it is. They didn't just help themselves. They helped every other American. They helped our country. They generated jobs and inventions and all of that. It's so absurd.
Yeah, and the racist factions of society throughout history move the needle every time. So it used to be the Irish and the Italians, Jewish people as well. And now we're here where we're demonizing the Latinx community, Mexicans, people that speak Spanish traditionally. And that's really what the Trump administration has gone after here, and demonizing those particular people. I think you hit the nail on the head there, John, talking about this. I just also think it's literally setting up immigrants to fail, because say you want to apply for a green card, you want to do things the legitimate way. A green card is so you're able to work, but if you weren't able to work before, you might have had to rely on government programs. But now you want to work, you want to get a green card, you want to be a part of this American dream, you know, fallacy that they keep pushing onto us, right? But you can't do that because, oh, you used government assistance before because you were starving and because you had no means to actually make money. You know, technically people without documentation are unable to use food stamps, but they made this so broad that say you like knew someone who had food stamps, or say you somehow benefited from some of these government programs, they can X you off. And I read in the PBS article yesterday that this could affect around 70% of green card applicants, which is a stunning figure.
Yeah, and a low bar for what they would like to actually weed out. They want to stop all immigration in effect. They will say that we just want the right sorts of immigrants, but that is not what their actual policies have indicated. Hopefully this is the sort of thing, by the way, not all of these horrid Trump policies will be of this fashion, but hopefully this is the sort that with the right president replacing him later this year, hopefully this can be changed relatively quickly, at least I hope. Okay, with that, why don't we turn to a little bit of good news? We're gonna have sort of the establishment striking back against Bernie Sanders in a later block, but for now, let's turn to something a little bit happier. Amber Schaffer is a comedy director with a great body of work, and she decided to produce an ad called Bernie, and it has to do with a Bernie perfume. Take a look at this, you're gonna love it. Okay, you couldn't see, but I actually, when they zoomed in on his face, I spit out my coffee. I love that. And partially it's because this primary has already been incredibly dirty and just mentally wearing. God, what a joyful little moment in the primary though, Emma.
Yeah, and I was about to say, you plebeian, John, you mispronounce it. It's Bernay.
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 Yes.
Yeah, the decapitated like action figure Bernie head on top of the perfume bottle is quite the touch.
Yeah.
And the part where he says, very sexy, and then it echoes, that's when I lost it, personally.
Yeah, and look, I love it. It's artistically beautifully shot, all of that. But look at this, like, the disconnect between what people who don't like Bernie, what they say about the reasons people do like Bernie versus even in this, which is a comedy endeavor, it's just a piece of art, it still comes back to the joyous thing is about getting rid of medical debt. At the end of the day, it's about ripping up and burning this crushing medical debt that we have. I just love that even in this sort of endeavor, it has to be substantive for Bernie Sanders supporters.
Yes, of course. I mean, because as he's always gone back to, it's not about him. If it was about him, I mean, they'd maybe replace him with like a newer model of who's has a gleaming white smile and like, tries to make it all about himself. No, it's always been about the message and the movement, and it's not me, us. And so when, even when we're, you know, there's this humorous ad about Bernie Sanders out there, it always returns back to the ideas, because Bernie Sanders is not a politician without his ideas, but there are a lot of politicians that are politicians first, ideas second.
Yeah. By the way, credit to producer Angel, the tears to billionaires. I like that. Okay. So that was fun. It's going to turn a little bit darker. We're going to take a quick break, but Emma's going to stick around. Everybody watching, stick around. We got lots more after this. Ancient political prophecies said that there had to be a balance in the primary force, and I've identified what that is. As more and more support lines up behind Bernie Sanders in both national polls and early state polls, on the other side, more and more of the people who hate Bernie Sanders and what he stands for are organizing against him. We've got the new details on that. When I say we, I mean me, but also Emma Vigeland, who joins us once again.
John, was that an Ancient Aliens reference?
Aliens, maybe. A little bit of Star Wars in there too. Okay. But anyway, Bernie's Anakin? I don't know. But Rudy is definitely Jar Jar.
Right.
Anyway, but this is important.
He's
because
Jabba, okay.
Nah, we'll go with that. Maybe Trump.
Okay.
He's a businessman after all. It's a cartel thing.
Right.
You know what? Let's just talk about Star Wars. Have you seen Mandalorian? I'm kidding. Okay, so there's a new anti-Bernie financial organization that is starting to form. It is loose at this point and not well funded apparently. But there are more and more of these forces in the traditional Democratic establishment, but also the donor establishment that are starting to organize as they see Bernie Sanders doing better in these polls. Daily Beast has a great article on this, which you should definitely look at, but I want to give you just a couple of excerpts. A group of loosely affiliated Democratic operatives have been in discussions about putting together an effort to attack Bernie Sanders should he end up winning next week's Iowa caucus and potentially the New Hampshire primary a week later, as polls indicate is likely to happen. Now, importantly, let's add on to that. The talks, which two sources described to the Daily Beast, are in their nascent stages and have already hit a snag. Big money Democrats have shown reluctance at funding such an effort, which could consist of ads attacking Sanders, and institutions associated with Democratic politics have largely shied away from being part of any campaign that goes after the senator, either out of fear over the backlash or growing acceptance at the prospect of him becoming the party's nominee. Now, that last bit has not been my experience from the articles and op-eds I've been seeing, which we're going to get into, but it is interesting that some of the expected establishment strike back against Bernie might be a bit diffused by the fact that they're worried about coming out against him. And also some of them might be like, looks like he's gonna win.
I think that it would be more vociferous if Trump were not the president, right? Almost people are, the establishment types are a little more scared to go full bore against a Democratic candidate because the alternative for them is someone they loathe so much and someone the base loathes so much. But not to say that they've been kind to Bernie Sanders. There have been article after article going after him. But I just think that it's pretty important to draw the parallels between Trump in 2016 and Bernie Sanders now, not in any way in terms of who they are as human beings, but in terms of how the party establishments have reacted to them. So in 2016, there was disbelief in the GOP establishment circles that Trump could win. And then he was leading in every poll and they started freaking out and they ended up backing someone they kind of hate too, but someone who they could potentially stomach in Ted Cruz. Now, we saw that really a little bit more recently with Bernie, right? So Elizabeth Warren is someone the establishment doesn't like. And you saw groups kind of being like, all right, her, she'd be all okay. But it just can't be Bernie. But there's been a growing acceptance from a select few in the Democratic Party establishment that no, Bernie could win this thing because he just keeps going up and up. He's likely to win Iowa. He's likely to win New Hampshire. He's likely to win Nevada. And that's three of the four first states. And then we're off to the races. And apologies to Elizabeth Warren there for comparing her to Ted Cruz. But it's just really kind of for the sake of comparison, in terms of the establishment reactions.
Yeah, and I want to give a bit of that establishment reaction because, I mean, look, I talked on the show yesterday, on the main show yesterday, about the Jennifer Rubin op-ed yesterday saying that Bernie was running a Trump-like campaign, which is just maddening. But
Republican Jennifer Rubin should always
exactly
be called.
Right? Well, I take all of my political advice from Meghan McCain and Jennifer Rubin, as every liberal should. So let's go to today. Jonathan Chaitz, running Bernie Sanders against Trump would be an act of insanity. Now, if you're not familiar with this author, you probably should be because libs tend to like him. He also wrote back in 2016, why liberals should support a Trump Republican nomination. So fabulous instincts, just amazing. But the thing is, when I say that the establishment is attacking him, it's like those sorts. But then also on the other side, you had David Frum's Bernie can't win. Now it's, and the thing is, look, Jonathan Chait, if you actually read the article, in like literally the first paragraph, he admits, okay, so he's beating Trump in the polls, he could probably win, but here's why it would be bad.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, there's New York Times op-eds out today. It's not like the establishment reaction has been cozy to Bernie Sanders. But the fact that there are at least some people behind the scenes trying to say, maybe an attack group going after him specifically from the Democratic side isn't the best idea, especially because when you read that Daily Beast article, it seems like there have been some donations to said group from organizations like Club for Growth, which are Republican conservative organizations.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that they might not opportunistically work with the right wing here as they have in some other cases, but it certainly does look dirty. To that end, we have a little bit of a video of at least one Wall Street Democratic mega donor. This is Steve Rattner, who apparently thinks that those concerns expressed in the Daily Beast article that there might not be the money there, he doesn't necessarily agree, as you'll see.
One, the more that Bernie Sanders rises, the more, and I see this very much now happening already among my activist Democratic friends, the more people are getting scared about a Bernie Sanders candidacy for two reasons. First, because they think he'll lose. And second, they think if he wins, he'll implement the kinds of policies that I outlined a few minutes ago, which are so far away from the center of the Democratic Party. So there's a lot of activity around trying to, quote, stop Bernie, although it isn't called by that just yet. And that's, and Mike Bloomberg could well play a role in that as an alternative to Bernie Sanders.
Which, look, he says he's not going to do, but that's obviously one of the fears. Although, if he's running as a third party candidate because of concerns that Bernie not being able to win, him running would ensure that Bernie and him would not win and that Trump would get a second term. So the entire thing is just nonsensical from the start.
Well, they're deluded enough into thinking that anyone would, you know, support Michael Bloomberg. But truly, I would be terrified of that. I think we actually talked about this in person last time on the show. The fact of the matter is that Bernie Sanders' path to winning the nomination, because he brings in so many, or winning the presidency, excuse me, because he brings in so many new voters, is actually easier than winning the Democratic nomination for him, because the way that the party has built its base, its entire fundraising operation for the past few decades has been centered around white kind of upper middle class liberals. And there are a lot of older voters who are terrified of him and really despise him. So he brings a lot of new people, independents, non-traditional voters into the fold, which would help him significantly in the general election. But when you're voting in a primary, it's just hardcore blue people. And it's harder to get that kind of outpouring to the polls. So long story short there, those voters, though, in that Democratic primary in a general election, the ones that love Joe Biden and are really risk averse and afraid of change, that could sway some percentage points away from Bernie Sanders if Bloomberg were to actually run as a third party candidate and could hand it to Trump. And so I think that threat is terrifying. And as the Chiron says there, it's real.
It is. I agree with you and the Chiron. Okay, I just want to briefly get your reaction to one more story involving Tom Perez. So Tom Perez is choosing people that are going to be effectively serving in this go around in various committee assignments inside of the DNC. And reactions are starting to pour into some of the names on this list. And I want to get Emma's reaction. Let's point out just a few of these individuals. You have the co-chair, Dennis McDonough, was Barack Obama's chief of staff. Vice Chair Danielle Gray was a former Obama administration official, is the senior vice president, chief legal officer, and corporate secretary for Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Yeah, that's a good one. Vice Chair Jake Sullivan is a member of the Alliance for Security and Democracy's Advisory Council. He was a senior policy advisor for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and 2008. Also national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. And you also have Bakari Sellers, who was a Kamala Harris surrogate and a surrogate for Hillary Clinton. Notably, the list is short on Bernie Sanders surrogates. And so I think that this gives you a little bit of an idea of where Tom Perez sees the short-term future of the DNC moving.
Yes, this is a step up from Hillary Clinton literally paying the bills for the DNC in 2016 because they were in such debt and her campaign was bankrolling their operation. So yeah, it's a little less rigged this time, but it's just a more soft rig right here, right? Where you just make sure that everyone in the party establishment is just hateful towards Bernie Sanders, antithetical to everything that he's trying to build. And yeah, I mean, to have surrogates from campaigns in this cycle is pretty odd in itself. And Bakari Sellers, everyone knows him from CNN, or people have seen him as a public face of someone who's been quite acrimonious towards Bernie Sanders. So
yeah,
it's just they're not even trying to give the appearance of objectivity / neutrality here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what he's known for, is being so hostile to Bernie Sanders. And also on the substance, I mean, these are bundlers and lobbyists. They're opposed to every position that not just like Bernie Sanders, but almost all of the Democratic candidates say they now support. This is belying that like fiction, effectively, like showing that they are stacking the deck with people who are going to be helping to write the Democratic platform, you know, in not that much longer. These are people who are they're tied in with insurance companies and fossil fuel companies and all of that. And honestly, if Bernie Sanders becomes president, to the extent that he can, one of the things that I am most looking forward to is a radical changing of the guard inside of the DNC. I want a durable change to their leadership, because I think that is going to pay dividends for quite a long time. I'm very much looking forward to that.
This would be like the GOP stacking their party establishment with gun control activists, or, you know, progressive immigration reform activists, right? It's antithetical to everything that the base wants.
Yeah.
The Republican Party embraces what their base wants, and the Democratic Party tries to put a firewall up between its base and what the decisions of the party actually are.
Yeah. Emma, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody go check her out at Rebel HQ. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks, John.
I want to take a short break here, but more after this. Joining us now to break down some of the ways we've ended up with this incredibly out of control price situation with our healthcare system is Dr. Marty Makary, health policy expert, surgeon, and professor of health policy, also the author of The Price We Pay: What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, John.
So look, I'm always looking to learn more about how we've ended up in this situation. So what are some of the basic things that people need to understand about the price of healthcare, how things have gotten so out of control?
Well, the issues that nobody's talking about, that we need to talk about, are pricing failures and inappropriate medical care. If you look at our entire healthcare cost crisis, the politicians are talking about different ways to finance it, but not how to fix it. And in order to fix it, we've got to talk about price gouging, predatory billing, which includes the extreme form that about 20% of hospitals engage in, which is suing patients to garnish their paychecks. This is a scandal that basically my team uncovered in a study we reported in our big medical journal. This is predatory billing, and it is now threatening the great public trust in American hospitals. And people need to stand up, and they need to know what they can do.
Well, you know, that's actually the one thing you just said there that I have not really heard anything about is hospitals suing their own patients, which seems like, on top of the incredible expense that you're already paying, the ultimate betrayal. Can you tell us a little bit more about the fight against that practice?
So doing the research for this book, The Price We Pay, I found hospitals that had sued 25,000 people in their town of 28,000 people by census data. These were number one Walmart workers, followed by food service workers, followed by postal workers, and even hospital housekeepers and maintenance staff. Look, most people don't live like me and the rest of the medical establishment. For half of America, they have less than $400 of cash on hand, and life can be a struggle. We've got to remember why we went into medicine. I mean, we have a commitment to serve people, not to ruin their life financially.
Yeah.
And so billing quality is medical quality, and we should measure these things. And I go to court defending patients who get sued, and we win 100% of the time, John.
Yeah, you know what's really interesting too is that we know that the cost is so high, obviously. But as you point out in the book, a lot of the healthcare spending doesn't go to things that have anything to do with health outcomes for patients. Tell us a little bit more about that. Where is all this money going? What are some of the sources of the inefficiency?
That we have a massive middleman industry in healthcare. And once again, a lot of people are getting rich, except for the patient. And this is on the backs of everyday American workers, that middlemen that I outline in the book, that medical establishment is making a ton of money. Just look at the earnings on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people are getting rich. How about we talk about food as medicine? How about we talk about the fact that nutrients aren't even in food anymore because of the lack of proper agricultural techniques? How about sleep and high blood pressure? How about healthy living? These are the issues that are now starting to get attention that have not gotten the attention of healthcare, and it is in the form of relationship-based medicine. We're seeing a wonderful resurgence now of clinics dedicated to what we call relationship-based medicine.
See, that sounds great, and it sounds like common sense. I've been meaning to sleep and eat better for a while. Is part of the problem traditionally that convincing patients that they need to do these sorts of things to maintain their health, that if they then go out and do that, any spending that comes from that goes to supermarkets or, you know, farmers markets? It doesn't go towards doctors, hospitals, those sorts of things. Is there a sort of implied bias against advice that goes to non-medicinal, non-hospital spending?
Well, look, we've had this bias in Western medicine that if there's no formal studies on it, then we sort of relegate it as irrelevant and we can't accept it because there's no big research on it. Well, guess what? The research dollars have not gone towards healthy eating and healthy living. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface. We demonized fat when there, it turns out there's nothing wrong with saturated fat for your health. An entire industry was created around healthy heart labels and demonizing fat. We had the milk industry tell us everyone needs to drink 3 to 4 glasses a day when the only good thing in their saturated fat we removed and added the worst thing, sugar. So, I mean, the entire industry has been messed up, and enough doctors now are saying, hey, can we get back to the basics of health? We spend a third of all our spending in healthcare on things that have nothing to do with health.
You know, and I have noticed, at least like inside of this presidential election that we're having right now, a lot of the policy conversation is around healthcare. I know that when people talk about their frustrations with their lives, a lot of it has to do with medical expenses, medical debt, bankruptcy, those sorts of things. Do you think that we are at a point now where people are thinking more critically about the system, that we're on the precipice of some major change or set of changes to fix these things?
Yes, I do, John. What's exciting, and the reason I'm optimistic about healthcare, is there is a movement now towards transparent pricing. People deserve a price. Look, if airlines did not have to give you a price for a flight and simply billed you after the flight, guess what? They would be gouging all over America. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have in healthcare. So people are asking for prices. They want high quality care. This broken system of you come in to see your doctor once a year and we tell you what to do, and then you go, you come back in a year and in 10 minutes we say, you bad, bad, non-compliant patient. Look, people want to do what's right. They need good information and they need the tools and the help.
Yeah. And so you have the book. The book is The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down what is perhaps the most important issue policy-wise that we're currently facing.
Thanks so much, John.
For everybody at home, we're going to take one more quick break, but I will see you on the other side. Okay, so it turns out we're having a little bit too much fun with Emma. We've gone over, we don't have time to do this last story right now. But what we are going to do is, after this show is done, if you head over to youtube.com/thedamagereport, I'm gonna be doing a live video that you can watch and comment. We can talk back and forth in real time. It's gonna be about a Colby Hall interview on Mediaite with Geraldo Rivera. Geraldo's a person I've given quite a bit of credit over the past few weeks. I'm gonna take a little bit of it back as I analyze some of the excerpts from this interview. So that's gonna be coming up in just a little bit. You're gonna wanna head to the YouTube channel, subscribe, hit the bell, all that YouTube-y stuff. Before that though, I do still encourage you, if you are a fan of the show and especially if you consume our podcast, which is available on all the platforms, to rate and review it on iTunes. I wanna read just one of the reviews. Let's see, Unhappy Marriage said, I love JR Wednesdays, two great newscasters, Trump voice, no fake news here. And let's see, we probably don't have time, but there's a couple of other great ones that have come in over the last day too. I appreciate reading those so much. Always thankful when people take the time to rate and review the show. It really is important for more people getting the message out there. So again, head to the YouTube channel. We'll see you with just a little bit more content in just a little bit. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.